Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Imagine looking out a window and seeing two shotgun-toting uniformed policemen walking towards your home. They're heading for your front door. Now, anticipating the knock, you cautiously open the front door. Besides a shotgun, one of the intense patrolmen is holding unfolded papers. He shows you an officially signed and stamped document and explains that they hold a warrant to search your house and seize all copies of the Bible. Well, why, you ask? The men hostily state, "The Bible is a seditious book. It is illegal to own copies, and you will be committing a crime if you read it." Now, does that sound far-fetched to you? Well, if you know the history, and maybe I should say it this way, if you know the true history behind the printing of the King James Bible, you'll know that that history shows us otherwise. So how well do you know the history of what led to the making of the King James Bible? Now, only a few people really know the history. And believe me when I say the history leading up to this publication of the King James Bible is worth knowing. And again, lest history repeat itself. It was really a very violent and turbulent time in history that brought us finally brought us the King James Bible. Now, I want to get into this history today, but we're going to have to go back to the first century. And to rely on this history, we need to actually rely on Bible history. Now, one of the things that we will talk about in future programs related to this subject of the Bible is really the Bible is divided into three separate sections, and three big general sections. One, it is one-third history. It is also one-third prophecy, and prophecy is just history of the future. And then, of course, the other third of it has to deal with doctrine and, let's say, elements of Christian living. So that's how you could really look at the Bible. But let's go back to the first century now, and I actually want to go back to the first century Judah, or we could go to the Palestine or to the Holy Land. And what we have to do is we have to look at Jesus Christ and the world he was born into. Now, he was born into a world racked by religious confusion, and it's really not unlike today. There is so much religious confusion in this world, and there really does not have to be, but there is. Now, one of the last prophets to Israel was a man named Malachi, and Malachi laid the blame for that religious confusion at the feet of a corrupt priesthood guilty of leading the reinstated Jewish nation away from God and his revealed way of life. Now, if you wanted to maybe get a pen or a piece of paper and write some of these things down, you could. But in a future program, I'm going to offer you an EPUB summarizing some of this material, so you wouldn't necessarily have to. But you can find in your scriptures, if you do have a Bible there with you, Malachi 2:8 talks about that, talks about what he did to the priest or what he said to the priest. Now, in the world that Christ was born into, the Jewish religion had become a mishmash of man-made traditions. It had been mixed with Greek philosophy, and there were also elements of paganism brought into it. Now, one of the things that Malachi had prophesied, and this was years before Christ was born, he did prophesy that a Messiah would come on the scene and he would preach the truth, or he would bring out God's message right from heaven. And if we look at what Jesus Christ did, that's exactly what he did. He said often as you read the Gospels, that he brought a message from God to this earth. Now, he did not come to fix the Jewish religion, and that is probably shocking to most people. He didn't come to change anything or fix it. The religious elite of his time didn't want him to fix their religion either. And so what we really learn from all this history, and again, it is recorded right there in the pages of the New Testament, is, and the fact, the sad fact is, most of the religious leadership hated Christ and hated his message. And so that is shocking to some people who really don't know their Bible well. When Jesus taught publicly, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, those were two opposing groups of religious people in Israel at that time, or Judah at that time. They openly challenged and they debated with him. Now, there were a lot of false charges laid against Christ. And of course, we know that even his crucifixion, right before his crucifixion, there was this monkey trial, convicting Christ of certain things, and it was all a sham. It was all wrong. It was all just lies, and so there was really no justice there. But the reason I bring this out is to answer the false charges or to answer the false doctrines of the Sadducees and Pharisees. Jesus Christ always said in front of the people, he said, "Have you not read?" Or in other words, have you not read the scriptures? And so the point I'm trying to make here is Jesus Christ, when he came to this earth, he did advocate Bible reading. And he intended not only for the religious elite to read the Bible, he intended for everyone to be able to read the Bible. Now, in Judaism, or at that time in Judah, they only wrote the Bible out by hand. It was on parchment, and some of it was on parchment, some of it was on vellum, and vellum, is lambskin that's, being able to put into a roll. But you could read in the scriptures, there's at least 12 times in the four Gospels where Christ says, "Have you not read the scriptures?" So in Judah, they could read them because the temples and the separate synagogues had their own library of the Bible. They could go in during the week, and they could read the text on the rolls or on the scrolls. And so people did have access to the scriptures. But you know that for those of us, let's say, in the English-speaking world, or those of us outside of Israel, that it's been rare that you could have your own Bible. It's been really, almost very recent within, the last maybe 500 years that people had access to their own Bible. And, maybe it's just a little bit longer than that. But it is really quite remarkable what we can do today. And if you remember back to last week's program, that's what's so alarming about people today is we have hundreds and hundreds of Bibles. They said that 92% of Americans have a Bible in the home, and some of them have up to four Bibles. But the percentage of people that actually read the Bible is much smaller than that. And so we have this opportunity, and there has been a lot of pain and suffering and actually martyrdom to have us to be able to do this. Now, when Christ said to read the scriptures, remember, he was talking about the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament Bible. And, it was written in Hebrew and Aramaic, and so there were several different languages involved in it. But the New Testament wasn't even begun until after Christ was, crucified, and then he was resurrected. And so Christ advocated reading the Old Testament. And how many Christian denominations today, which is still kind of shocking, where they only want the New Testament? And if you go to Bible bookstores, you can find, just the New Testament. And there are some people say, well, the Old Testament was done away, and, you can just get rid of it. But there are other scriptures, and we'll show this in future programs, that say the church is founded on the prophets, and the prophets were responsible for writing the Old Testament. And so So, you know, this whole idea about scripture reading has been, let's say, a part of the New Testament church since Christ, you know, walked on this earth, and that has not changed. Now, we know that through historical records that the fledgling New Testament church, something dramatic happened, and the church that Christ started, let's say, in 31 AD, by the time we get to 100 AD, it's a completely different church. And so we know that something dramatically changed, and a lot of scholars call it the lost century of the history of the church. And of course, we know through our own study here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and of course with the Philadelphia Church, we know that history of the church was actually wiped out. It was on purpose. People wanted to hide what was really going on between when Christ was let's say, ascended into heaven and what happened up to about, well, let's say 100 AD. But Christ established the tradition that there should be personal scripture reading and study. And it was maintained by church leadership. You know, we know from the early centuries, and we'll talk about this in the early part of the first century, let me put it that way. So, but personal Bible study was really emphasized. Now, the thing is, at that time, remember, a lot of the New Testament church were still Jewish, and they didn't have their own copy of the Bible, but they still had access to go into the temple and into the temple libraries and the synagogue libraries, and they still had, you know, the opportunity to you know, do their own check, do their own study. And of course, one of the most famous examples in the Bible is Luke in his Acts of the Apostles talks about the Bereans, and that's in Luke. Well, I shouldn't say Luke. It's in Acts 17 verses 10 and 11, where the Bereans, you know, they heard Paul preach, and then they went and they studied in their own scriptures to see if what he was teaching was true. And so the Bereans are held up as being so much more noble than other Christians at that time because they really did study the scriptures daily. Now, unfortunately, we know that the church very early on suffered intense persecution, and Jesus Christ even prophesied that in Matthew 24. In Luke 12, verse 32, he said that the church would always be a little flock, and it would, in Matthew 24, he says that we would suffer persecution. And so that really has happened. One of the other things that Christ prophesied in that Matthew 24 chapter, it's very often known as the Olivet Prophecy, is that there would be a group of evil men that would come along, and they would work to deceive not only God's true church, but the whole world about Christ, and that they would supplant Christ's own message with a false message about him. And history does prove that that has happened. Now, it's really, really kind of, shocking of what really happened. Now, it is interesting. There is in the Bible a real chronicle of this tension that developed between two churches. And the persecution, again, against the New Testament church started very early on. And we know that it was started by a man named Simon Magus. And it really is kind of fascinating history, but you're going to have to really kind of dig around. And you won't find this in a lot of secular sources. Now, we know the earliest persecution against the church came from the Jews, but the most deadly came from the ranks of Simon Magus's church and from his ministers. Now, you can find this all recorded in Acts 8. And, of course, Acts 8, Simon Magus came on the scene around AD 33, so the church was hardly 2 years old when he came on the scene. Now, we know that what happened is that Simon Magus did hear the preaching of Philip, and Simon Magus wanted to buy an office in the church. And we know that Peter spurned him, and that you know, he said, look, you have no part of this. And so essentially what Simon Magus decided to do then, he was going to start his own church, and he was going to try and wipe out the New Testament church. And that's why, really, there's this lost century. Now, even Paul refers to his war against Simon Magus' ministers in that first century. You can read those in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 2 to 4, verses 13 and 15. He talks about them again in Galatians 6 through 9. I'm not going to give you everything. The Apostle John had to fight against these men. But we do know from secular history that Simon Magus, I mean, Justin Martyr, he's a secular historian, Irenaeus, Eusebius, they say that by AD 45, Simon successfully laid the foundation for a competing church organization in Rome. So from AD 33, let's say where he came on the scene, it took till 45 AD that he could now kind of establish his church in Rome. Now, he called his church, it was really a mix of Babylonian pagan customs. And, of course, he selected certain Christian teachings he liked, but he distorted them. And essentially, because he was not allowed to buy an apostleship, he set his ultimate goal to, well, build his own church, dominate all religion in that area, and even dominate government. And essentially, he was really kind of an egomaniac. He wanted his church to, well, have world rule. Now, Simon's church, along with Christ's little flock, they both suffered slaughter at the hands of the Roman emperors for nearly three centuries. But then we know that there was Constantine the Great came along, and essentially what he did is he converted to Simon's church. And this was at this victory that he had at Milvian Bridge, and he supposedly had this vision that he saw this crucifix, this cross, and then he knew that he had to convert to some kind of a religion or to really unite Europe again. He was going to have, religion to do it. And of course, he did choose Simon's church. And at that time, this church had become the universal church or the Catholic Church. Now, I know that's shocking to people, but with the Edict of Milan in 313, Constantine kind of made a marriage of convenience with his church. And he used this church kind of as the means to, stop all the squabbling of the peoples in Europe. And so essentially he chose really a false brand of Christianity to unite Europe. And of course, if you listen to thetrumpet.com, if you're a regular subscriber to The Trumpet, we talk about this history quite a bit. But this was a shock, actually, to this universal church because, it had been persecuted by, the former Roman Empire. Now, this universal church is talked about in the Bible in several places. It's called a Babylonian queen in Isaiah 47. Revelation 17 has a little bit different description of it. Revelation 17, this church is called the Mother of Harlots. And essentially what it did, it palmed itself off as the promised kingdom of God. Now, one of the things that's interesting, and this is a fact of history, to legitimize its existence, it took its own gospel about the person of Christ, it made it appear as the truth. And a matter of policy, this church did cast the Bible aside, stating it was not sufficient for doctrine. Now, I know I was raised Roman Catholic, and being Irish as well, we were very dedicated. And, we were taught that. We were taught that the Bible was not sufficient for salvation. And also, as a Catholic, I was taught that we really shouldn't read the Bible because it could make you go crazy and that only a priest could interpret it. I was told that by my parents. So, this is not made up. This is true. Now, the Bible history of the universal church's Satan-inspired war to snuff out the true church, it's covered in several places in the Bible. It's in the book of Revelation. It's in the book of Daniel. And Revelation 12:6 does talk about the time when there was like this 1,260-year period where the church or the universal church really, you know, worked hard to wipe out the New Testament church. Now, we know that the years from 554 when Justinian, established the imperial restoration of the Roman Empire, and then, he really brought the Catholic Church into dominance. He used that to his advantage, just like Constantine had. And then for the next 1,260 years, or until 1814, when, Napoleon was crushed, you know, this is when that 1,260 years of intense persecution against the church happened. Now, that's a fact of history, and that's one thing that, of course, the Catholic Church would like to wipe out of history, and they don't focus on it. And I remember when I went to college and I took my first course on, let's say, the history of the Protestant Reformation, I was shocked at what I read about the history of what the Catholic Church had done. Now, why is this so important? Well, you have to understand that the scriptures actually were outlawed, and people were prevented from reading it. Now, if you look at the establishment of the King James Bible, all of the founding documents, and there are several things that happened over the years, let's say between on that 1,260 years, or between 554 and 1814, there were some things that happened that led to the making of the King James Bible. And it's really important that you understand this history. Now, this was a time period of great social upheaval in Europe. The Catholic Church had dominated the minds of people for years. The Renaissance came to life during this time period. But it's also at the time period when the King James Bible came into print. Now, as I said, this was a time of great social upheaval, but we have to realize there was a war over the Bible, and especially Bible translation, that was a major part of the unrest. And, God's people were branded as Judaizing heretics. That's a fact of history. By the church centered in Rome, and they had to flee constantly or to remain on the move constantly to survive martyrdom. But this happened to the church very early on anyway, and the first time the church had to really move was in AD 70, and that was just right before the fall of Jerusalem by the Roman leader. I think maybe I better be careful, not up on my Roman history, but Rome came in and sacked Jerusalem, but the true church had to flee. Now, if you look at Catholic history, it does chronicle their famous inquisitions. And, there is history about that. I mean, you can find it in secular sources. And it's in these chronicles that we do find, names for the people of God or the Church of God. Now, essentially what happened is beginning in AD 70, when the church had to flee, it did make its path west. They went north and west of Jerusalem, and eventually they ended up in the safety of the European wilderness. Now, this also happened during the 1,260 years. They kept moving north and west, and it was actually the same direction that the lost 10 tribes of Israel moved when they were, kicked out of their land. And so, but if you look at names like Albigenses or Bogomils or Cathars or Lollards or Paulicians or Waldenses, those are just a few of the names. You can read that in Catholic Church history. And these were people that did not submit to or bow to the Catholic Church. And they were considered heretics, and they were considered, really evil people. But these were the people of God. Now, it's really beyond the scope of this podcast to trace and discuss all of their locations, so I'm not going to bother to do that. But I can offer you a free publication, and it is titled The True History of God's True Church by Gerald Fleury, and it does give you this exciting history. Now, to obtain that book, you just have to get on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can either download your own PDF, or you can even have a request that one be sent to you. It really is a book worth reading. Well, it looks like I'm out of time for this program, but next time I'll continue this exciting background to the history of the King James Bible. Now remember, you can request a free copy of Gerald Fleury's important book, The True History of God's True Church. And again, that will be at thetrumpet.com. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.